Greetings, errants, glitches, breakaways, thought criminals, and genuinely open-minded and outright curious inhabitants of whatever simulacrum we find ourselves navigating at the moment. You are about to set sail on another free first-hour episode of The Melt. If you find yourself wanting to dig deeper and have the desire to join the conversation during our monthly Melt meetups, you might want to consider becoming a monthly subscriber. For a measly 5 dead presidents per month, you can have access to full-length, early, and exclusive episodes. Just click the Patreon or Locals link in the episode notes below to create the timeline that will set it all in motion. It's suspiciously simple, altogether painless, and just might inspire feelings of bliss and or lingering euphoria. So, without further ado, let the conversations begin! Hello, my name is Chris Snipes, and you are listening to The Melt. First of all, I would just like to address the sporadic presence of The Melt this last while. It came to a point in my life a few months ago where I was getting a bit burned out with the pace of my existence. I was feeling as if I didn't have enough breathing room. When I wasn't working 40 plus hours a week doing construction, spending time with my family, and spending virtually every free moment rushing to put out a podcast every Friday, I was sleeping. And nary a full night's rest. Even though I have put my intention out that I would like to be able to put much more energy, focus, research, and time into The Melt, right now it isn't bringing in enough promissory notes to make it feasible to ditch my day job just yet. Far from it. In the meantime, I cherish sanity. There are so many things that I want to do and learn about, and my schedule as it was just wasn't big on wiggle room, and I found myself less present, spread thin, and compromised energetically. So I made the decision to make The Melt schedule much more fluid. Instead of feeling that I have to get an episode out every Friday, I put one out whenever my life allows me to put time and energy into doing that. And although I still desire to have much more time to be able to utilize in imbuing The Melt with more content and attention, I feel like I need to take the time to find a more workable balance. So, I hope that you will be patient with us as we try our best to navigate these waters. I would also like to add that I am now getting into podcast production. If you like how The Melt sounds and you would like to apply that to your podcast, just let me know. If you'd like to enlist my services, just email me at themeltpodcast@protonmail.com. Today's guest is James Bartley, a renowned UFO researcher and investigator with a focus on alien abductions, the military connection to UFOs, and alien life forms. He has been researching these topics for over 25 years and has spent a significant amount of time conducting field investigations in the high desert of Southern California, Arizona, and Nevada. I start off the conversation by asking James to tell us a little bit about his background and about how he came to the kinds of subjects that he talks about in his podcast.
My name is James Bartley, and I've had my own ET encounters and UFO sightings, and also mixed in a number of what we now know as military abduction experiences, my lab experiences, and my experiences go back since childhood. And I wasn't always aware of this. It was a voyage of self-discovery for me. And I think what happened in my case, which helped out at some level, was I was always a student of history. I was always into learning about military history. I studied Greek mythology when I was a boy. So I was kind of open to a lot of these subjects anyway. As a young boy, I was always interested in the Bermuda Triangle, Bigfoot, UFO sightings, what have you. Never dreamed at a conscious level that I may be having some of these experiences or involved at some level.
Mm-hmm.
So I was like many other people, just going through life, working, going to school. And then a series of experiences hit me. When I came back from Germany, I spent a summer in Germany in 1990 in a language training course. Excuse me. And I had a series of experiences when I came back home to San Jose, California. And this compelled me to get into researcher mode. Whereas before, I wouldn't say I had a passing interest. I was always interested in these subjects. But now, back in September 1990, when I had all these experiences happen again, it forced me to reevaluate and do a life inventory, as it were. And I would, what I did was I took a pad of legal paper. Remember the big pads of yellow lined paper. And I just wrote out from memory every single unusual paranormal event in my life that I could recall. And after several pages, I realized whatever this thing was, it had been with me from as far back as I could remember. I didn't have a conceptual framework with which to understand it when I was younger, but after that series of experiences in September 1990, I just cleaned out the local bookstores of books about alien abductions and just read and read and read until I ran out of books to read from that particular store. And then I went into researcher mode, began sending away for material from various UFO researchers. And really, it wasn't until early 91, 92, 93 timeframe, 92, 91, more like it, I moved from San Jose, California, down to the bottom end of the state, San Diego. And in about a year, I joined the San Diego UFO Society and became a member in good standing and began networking with people all over the place that had experiences like myself. So that to me was a big turning point, because finally I was around people like myself. I didn't have to deal with a ridicule factor, the giggle factor. I'd bring the subject up amongst my college friends and they just laugh, right? So finally I was away from that, and I got around people like myself, and I began to do research on my own. Eventually I teamed up with Evie Lorgan. She's prominent in our field. And in the process, I got to know Barbara Bartholuk, who became my mentor, my spiritual mama, as it were. And she bestowed upon me 3 decades plus worth of her understanding and wisdom about alien abductions, reptilian abductions, et cetera, et cetera. So, and then in the process, I was conducting my own investigations in the high desert of Southern California. There were a lot of reptilian military type cases going on there. I began networking with a group of people in the high desert that had had my lab and reptilian experiences. And, it just kind of went from there. And over the years, I'd given lectures in a number of places, Philadelphia, Las Vegas, and elsewhere. So that pretty much sums up, what I've been into. And I feel that there's a lot of areas of the UFO research, alien abduction research field that are still being neglected. There still seems to be, and not casting aspersions on others or making a value judgment about others and their research methods, but there's still a lot of key information that's being left out of the mix, especially information that some might regard as being somewhat negative in nature. I really feel that those types of cases, especially the alien encounter cases, are where we can learn the most, and also the deep black military aerospace connection with non-human life forms, with the back engineering of alien technology. And this goes back at least to the early 1940s, we now know. So this compelled me to be a researcher in my own right and network with others and also eventually start my own podcast, The Cosmic Switchboard Show. So if any of your viewers and listeners are so inclined, they can go to thecosmicswitchboard.com and look up. We've got like 5+ years now of archive material. And I think there's a lot there for a lot of different people.
Absolutely. I can certainly attest to the show's excellence. You have a lot of great guests on there, and that's very high quality stuff in a field where some of the evidence being presented can be kind of flimsy, or you can get a lot of infighting in between different factions of people who want to say nuts and bolts, who want to say interdimensional, so on and so forth. But I think that your information and the people that you talk to are very high quality and very top notch. So I commend you on that. And I will definitely have the links in the episode notes so that people can find that. But so was it during the course of researching all this stuff that you uncovered the fact that you were actually involved in some of these projects throughout your life and maybe your childhood too?
It was only upon reflection and, doing that life inventory. For example, when I was researching the high desert of Southern California, there was an underground base there in the high desert near Victorville, the Apple Valley, Victorville area. And there's an element of naval intelligence that operates beneath this mountain. What they had done is there was a bunch of homesteaders living on this mountain and along the summit of this mountain. Somehow, some way, a firestorm erupted and burnt the people out of their homes. And before too long, cyclone fences went up around, the summit of the mountain there. And the first firefighters that showed up were not local firefighters. They were from a federal firefighting unit at Fort Irwin, which came from 60 miles away. Point being was, and it could be a coincidence, maybe there's something to it, but it was a means to get those people off that mountain where there's a lot of activity going on underground. There are parts of that mountain that open up similar to what eyewitnesses have seen at Dulce, Pine Gap, and other places around the world where, like, a roof will flip open or a part of the mountain will open and a craft or multiple craft will fly out. So people have seen similar things at that particular base. And it wasn't long before I was networking with the people that lived in that area and were being taken into that mountain and had encounters with reptilians and the military. And before long, I started having experiences being taken underground and being trained, as it were, with these other individuals that I'd gotten to know in the high desert. So we were starting to be taken as a group, not just individually at times, but as a group. And there were instances when I didn't even go to the high desert. I was still in San Diego when they still accessed me and put me together, put me through my paces in these training scenarios with these other people that I got to know in the high desert. And it was in that process that I started looking into my own background and realized that, I was from a Navy family. My dad was a career Navy guy. He'd served two tours in Vietnam in the Brown Water Navy. Then after Vietnam, he was assigned to aircraft carriers. And the carriers that he worked on with on board were home ported at Naval Air Station Alameda in the San Francisco Bay Area there. So, we lived for a while in Daly City, a suburb right next to San Francisco. And then when my dad was going to be posted to Naval Air Station Moffett Field further south, what is now the northern part of what we call Silicon Valley, right? In preparation for him being posted there, we moved from Daly City down to San Jose, California, to be closer to Naval Air Station Moffett Field. And it was I'd already started having experiences as a boy in Daly City, nosebleeds, missing time, what have you. But then when I got to San Jose, which is a hot spot for UFO activity and deep black military activity, I started having a bunch of other stuff happen. So when I did the life inventory, I realized that there was a lot of anomalous, curious aspects to my childhood. I had a problematic childhood as far as my health was concerned. And this compelled my parents. My mom was a career Navy wife, pretty much, and my dad was a career Navy guy. And when one of your children, your dependents, as they call us, in a military family, are ill or sick, well, they tend to take you to the military hospitals. They don't take you to civilian hospitals. And the doctors at these military hospitals tend to be high ranking, especially compared to an enlisted man like my dad, right? And my dad was a petty officer. Whereas the doctors tended to be, in Navy terms, lieutenant commanders, commanders, and captains. A captain would be equivalent to a colonel in the Army or the Air Force. So when a doctor slash superior military officer tells an enlisted man, okay, you got to bring your son here to this clinic, that clinic, give him these meds, my parents went along with it because that's what Navy families do. It's not because they were in on it. They were not part of any, bizarro cult or anything. I know those exist, but my parents were not a part of that. They were just concerned parents. And I think that it's possible that the health problems that I had as a boy were externally created, let's say, precisely to plug me into this covert military medical system, because I had a number of missing time experiences being taken to Oak Knoll Naval Hospital, which turned out later to be a notorious mind control center. A lot of the places that I was taken to as a boy, whether it was in San Diego, Naval Medical Center there at Balboa Park in San Diego, later became known as a place where some mind control and behavior modification was perpetrated upon people. And later I was taken to Oak Knoll Naval Hospital, as well as the Presidio, the infamous Presidio, Army Letterman General Hospital there in the Presidio in San Francisco. I was taken there and had a missing time experience. That's because part of the problem was that I don't know what justification or excuse they gave my parents, but especially as it pertained to the long trips from San Jose to Oak Knoll, and my dad was a painfully slow driver on top of that, right? They were under instructions, my mom was, to give me medication, ostensibly to fight off car sickness or something. I don't know what the justification was, but whatever the case, those drugs that were given to me by my mom at the request of the military doctors left me drugged out, groggy, and knocked me out. So there were times when I don't remember anything. Wow. From the long drive from San Jose to Oak Knoll Naval Hospital. On at least one occasion, I remember waking up. If you remember the old station wagons, there was the middle bench section, right?
Yes.
I remember waking up and seeing my younger brother next in line to me. He's like 4 years younger. Similarly drugged out, laying next to me on this middle bench of the station wagon we were riding in, and he was similarly drugged out, and I was groggy. And there were times when I'd wake up in a medical clinic and I have wires stuck through my head and what have you. So decades down the track, when I'm having these military abduction experiences again, by all outward appearances a deep black element of naval intelligence, and the fact that I was a Navy brat being at all these turned out to be later notorious military mind control centers, Oak Knoll Naval Hospital, et cetera, the Presidio, then I began to realize that not only have I had these alien abduction encounters all my life, but there was also this covert deep black military element too, because as a dependent in the military, the powers that be, the covert elements, would have had access to all my medical records. They would have known my blood type. They would have known my DNA profile. And I would submit that the deep black covert side of things has a far better understanding of DNA, of genetics, the morphic resonance field, and whatever latent innate metaphysical abilities people have, because that seems to be a factor as well, where not only do the people that have encounters with aliens, that some of these people seem to have innate psychic abilities, somehow at times they seem to be enhanced mm-hmm. in the presence of these ETs. Like they seem to be able to engender, bring out in the context of an ET encounter, these abilities even more. And it seems to me for some time now, the deep black elements of the military likewise realize that there's a substantial demographic that have these innate metaphysical abilities. They may not even be, these people may not even be consciously aware of them, but certainly the deep black military and that whole sub rosa covert element is aware, and they access military abductees and other project people and utilize, exploit these psychic abilities among other skill sets that people bring to the table. So I believe that is a factor too. They look for people, deliberately seek out people that have a certain genetic profile, that have certain innate, latent metaphysical abilities, and utilize them as operators, as operatives in some of these programs.
Well, were your parents aware of these, first of all, of these programs, but also of your participation in these programs, and were your siblings involved in them?
My younger brother, like I said, he'd had ET encounters, and then my youngest brother, likewise, has had ET encounters. And I'm sure that at some level, my next younger brother, the one I found lolling around, drugged out, you know, similar to the state I was in those car rides, that at some level he was used as well. As far as at a conscious level, my parents, no, I don't think they were aware of what it was they were getting me involved in. There was one occasion at the Presidio at Army Letterman General Hospital that my mom, following instructions, right, like a dutiful Navy wife, the dutiful Navy wife she was, took me into the lobby and then took me down a corridor, a far end of one corridor. And this was like on a weekend. There was like no one there. And took a specific elevator at the far end of a corridor, took it to a certain floor. And my mom took me to a door. And then that's all I remember. The next thing I remember is coming to consciousness in a dark room. And I fumbled around for the light switch. I fumbled around for the door. I found the door. I opened a door, and my mom is waiting for me at the other end. It's like whoever was behind that reanimated me or whatever, or brought me out of whatever state of consciousness I was in at precisely the time my mom was going to come back. Now, there were elements in my dad's life, which I didn't figure out till much later, that my dad, much against his will, was involved in clandestine covert operations in Vietnam. This is on top of, like I said, he was in the Brown Water Navy. He would have been taking part in operations like Game Warden, you know, going up and down the canals of the Mekong Delta, what have you, disrupting VC supply routes, et cetera, right? Inserting, extracting Navy SEALs and at times Australian SAS. And there were certain spooky elements to my dad's career. Like, for example, because he was of Filipino descent, outwardly he looked Asian. So there were times with no explanation, I only found this out decades after the fact, that the Navy saw fit to drop him off in a remote part of the jungle, leave him there for a certain period of time on his own. And then after a certain period of time, a river patrol boat shows up, Aussie SAS on board. And then they extract my dad. And, you know, my dad had no idea why he was there, what they were doing to him, why they wanted him to go there. Is it possible he experienced some degree of missing time or something was done to him? That's possible, yes. I'm not sure. But my dad was always taciturn. He was always very tight-lipped about his experiences. He was an introvert, an extreme introvert. So he naturally didn't talk about his Vietnam experiences. So, you know, I only pieced all this together. So there may have been this covert clandestine aspect to my dad's life, which he was not very fond of, on top of the activities he got involved with the Brown Water Navy, which were clandestine already, you know, inserting, extracting Navy SEALs, et cetera. Those come under the category of covert operations. So one could say that almost, I wouldn't say in textbook fashion, but there are many people that are come out of military families, let's say. For some reason, I think it has to do with access to the medical records and the DNA profiles and the blood types of these people. I think that, but they'll, with equal ease, they'll find people in the civilian world that have no overt connection to the military. They may have an aunt or an uncle or a grandfather in the military, but nothing overt as far as a everyday connection, right? They can still find those people in Civvy Street, but I think it's much easier for them to find the dependents of people in these military families, and certainly for those that are in the ranks. I've spoken to a number of people over the years. These are people that have had ET experiences, and they reported missing time experiences on board, or rather in their time in the military. Army, mm-hmm. Air Force, Navy, Marines. I've heard from people from all branches. I haven't heard from anyone in the Coast Guard yet. But they told me similar stories where they would have missing time periods while on the post. One of the people I knew was a gal that she was trained in photo interpretation, photo analysis, and also in photography. And her background also is very spooky. There's weird MyLab type elements in her life, as well as ET reptilian encounters. But she found herself working at Norton Air Force Base. And we found out, you know, later that it turned out that they were developing a lot of the classified, not to be shared widely, still and motion picture imagery of UFOs that was captured on gun camera films, et cetera, of Air Force planes and military aircraft. A lot of that was being developed at Norton Air Force Base. And she would report similar to, in a way, the things that have happened to me, where she would remember going to work, but wouldn't recall what happened there. Mm-hmm. And then she would just come home, right? And even when she was a recruit in boot camp, they did special things for her. They allowed her to have an off-base residence, whereas everyone else in her class, so to speak, they had to live on the base. But they set things up for her to be off base, I guess, make it easier to get a hold of her, right? And she reported interesting things like this weird episode on board of a cafeteria where she had some kind of medical episode. People in lab coats were looking her over and all this other stuff. Point being is that this happens to people in active duty service too. They somehow know those within the ranks that have ET experiences that have a certain genetic profile, and things begin to happen to them while they're still in the military. And this can follow them after they get out of the military as well. So I hope I answered your question.
Absolutely. Do you think when it comes to recruiting people for these programs that when it comes down to the convenience of maybe forcefully enlisting a child of somebody that's already involved in the military, or between somebody that has maybe a special ability that they're looking for, which of those would be more important? Is it more convenient just to handpick out of the kids that are the, as you said, the military brats? Or do they also have testing programs where they test lots of different people and will pick children out of those programs, regardless of their involvement in the military or not?
That's a great question. I think they do both. I think that they take people from the general population as children, and they put them through their paces with psychological exams, psychological profiling, testing for psychic abilities, what have you. It's easier for them to do it with the military brats, the military dependents, because often it's not, they're on a military post. So they have, they live in military housing like I did as a boy in Daly City, California. So you're in a, like, for example, I would walk in when I was a boy And there was an older, tall Caucasian man sitting there talking to my mom about me, right? For some reason. So I'd be trying to eavesdrop, but I never really picked up anything. And I asked my mom about it years later, but she couldn't recall what those discussions were about, or even recall the person I was referring to, the big, tall Caucasian older gentleman that was, you know, sitting in our living room talking to her about me. So I think that they have like a dragnet where they identify likely people also because their sensors are such that they can pick up UFO activity. Some of these craft emit frequencies that can be detected and have been detected for a long time by the sensors of the military. So in our example, say that they've picked up anomalous electromagnetic activity, which suggests an ET craft visitation in a certain neighborhood, and say, according to their records, this has happened on a number of occasions, two or more occasions over the last X number of months, X number of years, then they will begin doing background investigations on everyone living on in that neighborhood. And it will not take them long. This is even before, you know, today's digital world. Back then, they had acres and acres of Cray supercomputers to churn out all this data and churn out all this information. Plus, we now know that there has been an ongoing interaction, treaties, plural, if you will, between deep black elements of the government and certain ET civilizations. And according to the information provided by Dan Sherman, I have no reason to doubt it, because it really has the whiff of truth, if you will, that if you're familiar with Dan Sherman's story, Project Preserve Destiny, he was a intuitive communicator. He was raised from even before birth to one day take part in the Air Force Security Service, now known as the Air Force Electronic Security Command, the Air Force subsidiary to the National Security Agency. He was groomed from before birth to take part in that program. His mother was an alien abductee. While he was still in the womb, the Zeta Reticulan Grays were doing things to enhance his psychic connection, his psychic ability. So by the time he was born, there was these outside external influences that kept shunting him in certain directions, putting through this course, putting him into this school, putting him into that program, eventually getting him into the Air Force, where eventually he was pulled into what he called the Gray Program, which is even of a higher security level nature than a black program. And because of the modifications, enhancements to him, genetically and neurologically and otherwise, by the Zetas, he was groomed from birth. Like I said, his mother was an alien abductee also, and so was Dan. He was groomed from birth essentially to be one day a intuitive communicator. And in the early 1970s, he was read into this Gray Project, as he called it, Project Preserve Destiny. And the purpose was, he was told that one day the grid's going to go down, there's going to be this cataclysm on the surface, and they're going to lose all communications. However, they were going to still need to maintain comms, communications, with this particular ET race, the Zeta Reticulians, at least in that program. There are probably other similar programs. So he was groomed to be an intuitive communicator, a psychic comm link between Air Force Security Service, NSA, and the ET races, the Zetas. And the information that would come to him from these two Zetas that he was in contact with, they turned out to be a number, a serial number designation, right? A series of numbers. And he realized that they referred to coordinates, times of abduction, and times of return, and the serial designator number referred to individuals, presumably alien abductees. As part of this treaty, where, so the story goes, certain ET groups were allowed to abduct a limited number of people, but return them with their memories erased, in return for technology and probably technical advice, technical know-how as well. So that's just one example of how Dan Sherman, as a boy, even before he came into this world, when he was still in the womb, he was being groomed for this. Now, in some of my experiences, and I've heard this from other people too, you know, I've seen kids, I've seen children, presumably in these programs too. In some of my experiences, I'd be doing an endless amount of running, more running than I could do in my normal waking consciousness, right? But in some of these experiences, this happened a lot to me in the 1990s, when I was still living in San Diego. I would have these endless dreams of just running and running and physical training. And in some of these experiences, I saw children being put through their paces as well, right? So it wasn't just like adults and young people that were being put through their paces. They had children that they were already working with. And some of my memories include, you know, vague memories of being in a dark room and being given what amounts to like psychic ESP test, right? And there was this woman there that seemed to be running the show, kind of like short page boy kind of haircut kind of looking thing. And then I remember reading somewhere of someone who described a similar experience or memories, fragmented or otherwise, of being with other kids and being put through their paces as far as testing. And that's what happens a lot with these MyLabs and project people. They're subjected to a lot of psychological profiling, emotional testing, emotional bonding. They'll do things to people individually and in twos, you know, in duos, one and another person, or collectively in a group, where they psychically psychologically and psychically profile them, and they do things to enhance their cohesion as a group, enhance their regard, their feelings, their care for one another, enhance it, right? Maybe the theory behind it being that if they're put through their paces in the training, they'll meld and work together better. And later in a real world scenario, they'll be able to work together better if they had already been pre-bonded, if you will. So I do remember a number of times in a high desert, now, by now I'm an adult, when me and a group of other MyLabs are being put through these emotional kind of experiences where we're kind of force-fed into working with each other. In one scenario, the military like made us an offer we couldn't refuse as a group. They said, if you go along and you know, do what we want, then you'll get all these riches and all these other unspecified goodies, right? And of course, it was just a test to see which people would go for it in our group. And I didn't know everyone in the group, just a few of the people. And when some of the people went along with it, yes, I'll go along with, you know, the program as long as we get these bennies, these benefits back in return, right? I remember being so emotionally overwrought and just crestfallen, just crying and just totally inconsolable that some people had fallen for that, had gone ahead for, you know, just money, remuneration, selling themselves out, essentially. And I remember just crying and weeping and people consoling with me and then consoling me. And then what we used to do is, after we'd have these shared experiences, we'd call each other up on the phone. And then later, as the internet kicked in, we began sharing emails with one another, sharing, you know, dreams and experiences, mutual experiences we'd had the night before, you know, to kind of compare notes, see who can fill in the gaps of one or the other person, right? And so we began talking about that experience we just had where, as a group, we were confronted with this temptation. And the fact that some people went along with it, we didn't make a value judgment against them. That was just the nature of the scenario. And just to digress for a second, there's other examples too, where they will try to bond people, but if it won't work, they'll try to bond them with someone else, like males and females, for example, right? Okay, it didn't work with this couple. Let's try it with these people. So that happens a lot too. Anyway, they all described me being inconsolable and crying and weeping because some people had succumbed. Then afterwards, because like so many other researchers, we were pretty much destitute, broke most of the time, the working poor, right? We made a joke, well, next time they offer it, well, let's just go for it, you know, to hell with it, right? Of course, never did, but we made a joke out of it, right? Don't anyone take me seriously there. But, yes. You know, I mean, you have to laugh at these things sometimes.
Of course.
So I hope I answered your question. But yes, they will take large swaths of the population, and they will, there's certain markers, certain criteria, I think it's not just to do, and this is going to sound kind of far-fetched, it's not just the DNA profile. It's not just the innate metaphysical powers contained in someone's morphic resonance field and in their genetic profile, but they also have a deep and abiding interest in who these people used to be in previous incarnations. I know people that have been interrogated about their past lives, not just interrogated about, okay, what do you know about the aliens? What have they told you? What kind of ETs are you, you know, in these harsh interrogations that so many my lives have been subjected to in the past? They have an abiding interest in sometimes in who we used to be because we are the sum of all of our parts. And to me, there's only the eternal now. Past, present, future coexist, run in parallel at times through some quirk or whatever astronomical alignment, electromagnetic anomaly. There are juncture points where the twain meets, right? And these ETs, as they told Dan Sherman, as they told a number of other people, some of these ET civilizations are absolutely capable of time travel. They can, as they told Dan Sherman, they can go around time, right? And I've had experiences where I was returned to a point in time before I was abducted. Okay, I was abducted after midnight and had a horrific experience. And then when I was returned to like 10 p.m., 2 hours plus before I was abducted in the first place. So either they made a mistake when they returned me or they did it on purpose as kind of an object lesson. So I know from personal experience and also one of my friends who's had a lot of military abduction experiences, a lot of reptilian experiences in the high desert, I've had her on my show. She reported to me that she could be with them being trained and living not just off-world. There is an off-world program that Ben Rich and others have alluded to. I'm not talking about that. It's all part of it, though. But they told my friend, and I have no reason to doubt this, because it's been corroborated from other sources, too, that the deep black military and aerospace community have long since had the ability to operate in what amounts to other dimensions, where time flows differently. And Lorena would tell the military, I have to get home. My daughters are going to be waking up pretty soon. I have to get them ready for school. I mean, we're talking about where the mundane clashes with the extraordinary, right? And they would always tell her, don't worry, we're going to return you. And you wake up and you have plenty of time to get your kids ready for school, plenty of time to get breakfast going, et cetera, et cetera. So what Lorena told me was there were times she spent seemingly weeks at this other place, living in this, what was described to her, she was not only underground beneath that mountain in the Apple Valley area that I mentioned earlier, but at times it would take her to these installations, which the military had set up in what amounts to another reality or another dimension. And they gave her a technical explanation for this. She couldn't understand what they were talking about, right? But every time they returned her, she would wake up. And it was like a seamless transition, like she'd never been gone.
Wow.
Even though from her conscious recall, and Lorena was one who always exhibited an astonishing amount of conscious recall in her experiences, far more than me. Because she would say, yeah, you were there. That wasn't a dream. I saw you. I was trying to wake you up, because often as not, I'd be like in a zombied out state in some of these experiences, right? And you know, what I would come back with are fragmented memories, you know, of some kind of odd dream where I saw some of my fellow MyLab friends, right? And Lorena would say, no, that was, we were really there in this underground base. We were really there with these military people. And I was trying to wake you up, and I was pointing out that she was touching things. letting me know that, you know, these surroundings are real. You're not in a dream, right? There were other times when I had more conscious awareness, but Lorena generally had a lot of conscious awareness. For whatever reason, she was one of those people that either, and it was probably equal parts, where they deliberately allowed her to have a certain level of conscious awareness, although there were times they also used memory erasure and mind control in her. But I think she had an innate ability. And what's interesting, we talk about bloodlines, Chris. Her bloodline comes from, if you remember the Carlos Castaneda books and his mentor, Don Juan was a Nagual.
Yes.
From, I forget what kind of Indian tribe, but it was there just south of the Arizona border in Mexico, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And that's the bloodline where Lorena came from. Her mother's side of the family was the same, essentially the same, the Yaqui Indians, okay, was essentially the same bloodline mixed in with Hispanic, where Don Juan's mentor came from, right?
Interesting.
And the deep black military knew about this. Now, she was strictly civilian. Here's an example where they seem to know, okay, because their sensors and also the reptilians that were in cahoots with deep black elements of the Navy, they actually shared the same facility. There were places in that underground base where there was the military predominated, but there were also sections, tunnel entrances and tunnel systems where there were reptilians. And the military were absolutely cognizant of the efforts and what the reptilians were up to, because they seemed to work at times in unison with Lorena and other people. So what would happen is, like in one instance, this reptilian came to Lorena. This happened a number of occasions, had sex with her. In so doing, really amped up her chi, her psychic abilities. And you will hear this from women who've had sexual encounters, rapes from reptilian beings, is in some instances, in the hours and days after the sexual encounter, their psi abilities are enhanced. There's something to do with the Kundalini rising, whatever the case may be. I could only speculate, right? But in her case, the reptilian came, had intercourse with her, left. No sooner had the reptilian left than the military teleported her to the underground base, and they immediately started tasking her with remote viewing because she was in a highly psychic state. It came about as a direct result of the reptilian ramping up and charging up her chi and her sexual, you know, through sexual intercourse with her, right? And this is something that adepts can do, warlocks can do. And if you ask me, a lot of these adepts and warlocks themselves are reptilian or Draco hybrids, right? So they have this ability also when it comes to the Scarlet Women in certain ceremonies, whatever the case may be, to enhance the psychic ability of the woman that they're, you know, thus violating. So something along those lines happened to Lorena where the reptilian came, either the military and the reptilian had an understanding that they would do this, or because they're monitoring Lorena, right? And, what the reptilian just did to her, now let's abduct her and, you know, make her remote view for us, right? So the story I almost forgot was, as a young girl, get this. No overt connection in Lorena's mother's side of the family, right? All outward appearances, Hispanic American family, but actually her bloodline goes back to the Yaqui Indians. Somewhere along the way, mm-hmm. her mother was befriended by a Navy guy. The purpose of which was to access Lorena and her younger sister. The guy was a pedophile. Hmm? So he engages in a relationship with Lorena's mother, but really the purpose was to access Lorena and her sister, who were young girls at the time, violate them and thereby traumatize, dissociate them, get the whole ball rolling in that regard, right? So that's an example of they must have known because of the sensors going off, the close proximity of ET craft, whatever the case may be. And I believe, as was the case with Dan Sherman, I'm kind of cycling back to these different talking points because I believe that some of these ET groups will tell the human side of the so-called alliance. Okay, we're going to be working with this person. We've been working with this person. We've been working with this family, right? So I think at some level that happens as well, because they sent a Navy guy, pedophile, in to get in a relationship with Lorena's mom. That was really just a ruse to access Lorena and her sisters. I've heard this story from other, a similar story from other women too, where these pedophiles come into their lives, either, family member, extended family, a perfect stranger, right? But the end result was to traumatize the children, the girls in our example, split them off and prepare them for a lifetime of mind control. And Lorena was always trained in paramilitary activities. And what's interesting in Lorena's case and others, another gal that we work with, she's since passed on, Donna Hendershot, a dear friend of mine, they will take the skill set of the people on the service that they're abducting as My Labs and project people, and they will utilize them in some of these projects, sub rosa, literally underground or off world, as a case, whatever the case may be. If someone has like a biochem kind of medical background, they will use those abilities in their black projects. If someone, like in Lorena's case, in Donna's case, they were both encouraged by their military controllers to become first responders, to become firefighters, to become EMTs. And that's what they became. Lorena became a volunteer firefighter. Donna also was involved in, as an EMT and working as a first responder. So they will not only take people and use their available skill sets, they will encourage them, if you will, probably some degree of coercion, mind control, whatever the case may be. So in their surface level existence, they consciously seek to become a certain type of, get into a certain profession, a certain line of work. And that's certainly, I mean, we see this in the surface world where the CIA will send somebody into the city of London or into Wall Street to learn how to be a financier, learn how to be a banker, whatever the case may be. Similar dynamic occurs with the deep black military, medical, aerospace, covert operations, where they will encourage people to get into certain fields or professions, certain types of training, and then utilize those skill sets in these black projects. So anyhow, I got a boogie, but it's been great talking to you.
Okay.
And yeah, let's do it again sometime.
Okay. James, thanks. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you. Bye.